Hi, and welcome to the magazine Rack on Chris. I'm Ron Pariser. Today, I'll be reading from the July-August issue of Yankee. The first article is written by Mel Allen and titled Summer Times. Sometimes, when I write my editor's note, the unexpected happens. While reading the pages of this issue last week, I thought about how summer memories seemed to hold on tighter than those of any other season. So I started writing down mine, certain that many reading this will remember their own. Twilight. We chase fireflies, we ride bikes up and down the street. Then suddenly comes the jingle of the ice cream truck as it turns toward us. No day could offer a better end than this. 4th of July. My sister and I scoop up our baby brother and dash in and out of the lawn sprinkler. Our Springer Spaniel is torn between the tantalizing scent of my father's grill and our calls to join in. After mowing, the smell of cut grass washes the air. The heat of the day is just beginning. I go to the neighborhood ball field for a pickup game with friends. No grown-ups, just bats and balls and time. And here is what might happen when you start writing summer memories. Out of nowhere, one pushes aside all the others. On the night of July 20th, 1969, I watched Neil Armstrong step onto the moon with One Small Step for Man. I remember the moment for its magnitude, of course, but also because I was at Bill Freeland's home, and it was the last time I would see the teacher who, perhaps more than anyone, led me to the writing life I have known. I first saw Bill Freeland when I was 11. He was probably in his late 20s. It was 1957, and he was standing outside the little Quaker school I attended. He was not only a new teacher, but also the first male one I'd encountered. Although he was imposing, with a thick mustache, what struck me most was the fact that he was wearing sandals. I asked why. Frostbite in Korea, he said. I blurted, "Did you shoot anyone?" And I have never forgotten this. He looked at me, then softly and deliberately he said, "You never asked that question." He taught art, reading, and PE. He built sets for school plays. He'd turn off the classroom lights and read Edgar Allan Poe to us. As we memorized Tennyson and Longfellow, he made us care about the sounds of words. He was larger than life to all of us. 2 years later, he left to teach at an art college, and in time his own art and sculpture would gain a following around the world. The summer of 1969, I came home on leave from the Peace Corps to get married. The one person I wanted my future wife to meet was Bill Freeland, so I phoned him up. It had been more than 10 years since I'd been his student, but he invited us both over to watch the moon landing, and when we left, he gave us a painting. A year later, I, too, was teaching children, and I, too, turned off the lights and read aloud to them. I wrote to him to tell him that. Afterward, I lost touch, as it is too easy to do, and then in 2009, I read he had died at age 80 in Ireland, where he had a studio. I lost his painting some years ago, after one too many moves. But even as I type this, I am back in that dark classroom, the one where Bill Freeland is reading aloud and giving us chills we don't even understand. And I do not know it then, but I am taking my first small steps on the path that led me here. Mel Allen. The next article is written by Susie Spiekel, illustrations by Christian Blaza, and titled Bats Count, Tallying the Charms and Challenges of Our Only Flying Mammal. I love the soft twilight of summer evenings, when the warm air is rich with the scent of night-blooming flowers, and fireflies flash across the meadow like earthbound shooting stars. On one of these evenings, at the edge of a dirt road in southwestern New Hampshire, a few friends and I gather in front of the velvety darkness of an old barn's breezeway. The throaty jug-a-rum love song of bullfrogs and the buzzy chirr of lonely crickets float around us. I lean toward the barn, listening for the whispery rustling of leather wings and a high-pitched chatter. Mosquitoes feast on me, biting through my sweatshirt and the tangle of my hair. I don't care, because I'm clutching a silver counting clicker, and I'm the happiest I've been all summer. On this night, I'm counting bats. I've always had a soft spot for bats. For Halloween, I dressed as a bat, and later as Merlin Tuttle, a renowned bat scientist. Wherever I could find bats, I did, in the pages of books, at the Bronx Zoo, and even along the wild edges of New York City, where my family lived. But mostly, I waited for summer, and for nights filled with the soft swirl of bats hunting on the wing. Each summer, my family would leave our crowded Brooklyn neighborhood for the rolling hills and wide-open meadows of southern Vermont. At night, we lay in the field under the stars, listening to my mom's stories of long-ago heroes, untamed villains, and fantastical creatures like the immortal Fiery Phoenix. I watched bats hunting mosquitoes and moths across the blanket of night while she spun her tails. For me, the bats were their own story, mammals that flew instead of walked, slept by hanging from their tiny toes, and hunted not by sight but by sound. They became more legendary in their realness to me than any ancient myth. For many people, bats rank right up there with snakes and spiders among the most disliked creatures. Cloaked in the mystery of night, forever paired with Dracula, and linked to diseases such as rabies and, more recently, COVID, this diverse group of mammals is often stigmatized and reviled. Perhaps that's another reason I have always loved them. These furry flyers need champions. And lately, they need all the champions they can get. Once considered the most numerous bat in New England, the little brown bat has seen its numbers drop to dangerously low levels due to white nose syndrome, a fungal disease that often proves fatal. I cannot bear the thought of a world without these tiny beings. Who else will eat thousands of mosquitoes and other flying insects every night? Little browns consume over half their body weight every night in insects, eating more than 600 insects per hour. Admire them for their voracious appetite, but also because their echolocation hunting technique inspired scientists to develop sonar technology, a discovery that continues to have far-reaching implications. Or maybe be like me, and just love the little brown bat for being exactly what it is, a little brown bat. For the past few years, a few friends and I have gathered at the edge of the night each summer, devoured by mosquitoes, but caught up in our mission. We are volunteers for a collaborative project between UNH Cooperative Extension and New Hampshire Fish and Game. The Bat Count Project is a statewide community science effort that helps bat researchers determine the population of New Hampshire's little brown and big brown bat populations. Data collected by volunteers observing bat maternity colonies, most often found in human-built structures like barns, have proven invaluable to researchers. As twilight dims, the old barn lets loose. Bats tumble out from slivers of space between the roof and walls, and swoop out from the open breezeway. Some of us record in notebooks, while others use counting clickers, ticking off bat after bat. We count them leaving, and we count them returning. It is fast and furious, and I'm exhilarated. We count until it gets too dark to see, and all that's left is the swish of air near our ears as the bats zip by, feasting on the mosquitoes, feasting on us. In the end, we tally our numbers and compare them to recorded figures. We do some simple math, subtracting the number of bats flying back into the barn from the number of those exiting the barn to get a total population count for the night, and then we celebrate a little. In the midst of all that is hard and sad in this world. The next article is by Jen Johnson, and titled Going for Gold. Plunge into a sea of sunflowers at Vermont's Billings Farm and Museum. Of all the possible locations for engagement photos, orchards, covered bridges, ocean beaches, the workplace usually doesn't rank high on the list. unless, that is, you can step outside your office into a wonderland of sunflowers. As Director of Education and Interpretation at Billings Farm and Museum, Christine Scales had exactly that opportunity in the form of the Sunflower House, a display of hundreds of red, orange, and gold blooms that's said to be the largest of its kind in the nation. The little brown bat persists. Its numbers reflect a slow increase. The population is nowhere near what it was when I lay among the grass next to my mother, but like her stories under the night sky, it reminds me of perseverance, of how life longs to survive, why something like a little brown bat matters, and how, like the phoenix, it continues to fly. And that promise fills me with a fire of hope. The next article is by Jen Johnson, entitled Going for Gold, Plunge into a Sea of Sunflowers at Vermont's Billings Farm and Museum. Of all the possible locations for engagement photos, orchards, covered bridges, ocean beaches, the workplace usually doesn't rank high on the list, unless, that is, you can step outside your office into a wonderland of sunflowers. As Director of Education and Interpretation at Billings Farm and Museum, Christine Scales had exactly that opportunity in the form of the Sunflower House, a display of hundreds of red, orange, and gold blooms that's said to be the largest of its kind in the nation. Launched in 2019, it's become a summer sensation at the four-decade-old Outdoor History Museum in Woodstock, Vermont, attracting media coverage, flocks of visitors, and yes, professional photo sessions. It's so joyful, it's just impossible to take a bad picture in there, says Scales, who had her own engagement portraits taken in the Sunflower House in 2020. We've had people book it for maternity photos, family photos, and we even had two wedding proposals in the Sunflower House, both successful. Fittingly, this fairy tale garden has a bit of magic in its origins. A children's book featured in Billings's preschool story, Our Program, Eve Bunting's The Sunflower House, had gotten the museum staff thinking about creating their own sunflower house, a simple 8-foot circle of flowers that could be a living play space for kids, maybe like the one in the book. Then came a fateful meeting with Ben Pauley, Director of Property Operations and Design at the Woodstock Inn and Resort. We had gotten together with Ben to talk about a new garden shed we were putting in at Billings, and we happened to ask if he'd ever heard of a sunflower house before, Scales recalls. And he didn't say anything at first. He just pulled out a folder full of pictures of sunflower houses and his whole plan for creating one, and on a much larger scale than what we were originally picturing. Pauley, it turned out, had already been mulling a show-stopping new garden project at Billings Farm and Museum, which, like the Woodstock Inn, is owned and operated by the nonprofit Woodstock Foundation. Some may have thought that a corn maze would be the better thing to do to make a big impact to bring people to Woodstock. It's a classic Vermont fall attraction, says Pauley. But my feeling was, nobody else has a sunflower house. Besides, he adds, a maze is all about finding your way out, but a house is something you want to inhabit. You want to be part of it and feel comfortable and experience everything around you. Working with the idea of creating rooms and hallways in a living structure, Pauley designed and planted the first sunflower house for summer 2019. Set on a quarter acre and featuring about a dozen kinds of sunflowers, the result made a big impression. It was this beautiful, amazing, magical thing, Scales recalls. When I saw it for the first time, I immediately thought, yeah, people are going to want to come to see this. They're going to come from all over to see this. As popular as it was the first year, the Sunflower House boomed the next, when the need for outdoor, socially distant activities saw people streaming to places like Billings. And the crowds were back in 2021 to experience an even bigger iteration of the Sunflower House that sprawled over nearly half an acre. That year marked a new record for museum attendance. The 2024 Sunflower House, which is expected to peak in late August or early September, is laden with more than 50 varieties ranging in height from 12 inches to 14 feet and bearing names like Lemon Cutie, Just Crazy, and Starburst Panache. Rounding out the 20,000 square foot installation by Paulie and Taylor Ayers, a fellow Woodstock Inn master gardener, are 50 sunflower buddies, zinnias, marigolds, etc., to expand the color palette and extend the bloom time. Like the sunflowers, the companion plants are all annuals, so after this year's sunflower house dies down, a completely new one will rise next year. It's a structure that's not meant to last, but it does serve a lasting purpose, to nourish the birds and bees, and to provide visitors with garden memories that will never fade. BillingsFarm.org. The next article is by Mel Allen, entitled Everlasting Glove. A century-old Vermont company is turning out a product that a lot of folks want to get their hands on. When Sam Hooper was growing up on his family's farm in Brookfield, Vermont, he worked alongside his parents and brothers, haying, cutting wood, slopping pigs, repairing fences, clearing snow, a multitude of chores all done by hand. The rugged labor took its toll on his work gloves. "I'd go through 5 pairs in just a winter," he recalls. Until one day, he put on a Green Mountain brand pair. They were meticulously handmade from goat skin, a craft honed and perfected by 3 generations of the Haupt family and their small company in the nearby town of Randolph. And that day is when this glove story begins. "I went, wow," Hooper says. "I was floored by them, by how comfortable they were, how supple and flexible, and so durable that he could not wear them out. Hands down, they were unlike any he had ever worn." Hooper eventually went off to college in Connecticut. Upon graduating in 2016, he returned home to work in the marketing department of Vermont Creamery, which was founded by his mother, Allison, and Bob Reese, and known nationwide for its butter and its specialty cheeses made from cow and goat milk. Soon afterward, he learned that Kurt Haupt Jr., the third generation to own Green Mountain Glove Company, was preparing to retire. The company was struggling. A few years earlier, a major garden supply retailer that featured Green Mountain work gloves as a top-of-the-line product had been sold to a national corporation, which chose to offer cheaper, mass-produced gloves. Even the company's core business, protective gloves made specifically for line workers, a product that needed to be flawless to ensure their safety, was under increasing pressure from overseas manufacturers. One of the country's last local glove makers was fighting to survive. Hooper, then 23, had long been fascinated by the manufacturing process. At the creamery, he had seen raw milk become 4 million pounds of products sold to people who loved them. Green Mountain Glove Company had been in Vermont since 1920. And unlike young entrepreneurs who flocked to startups, Hooper had this feeling, this optimism, that he might be able to stitch his ambition and vision to its existing legacy. In the summer of 2017, he went to see Kurt Haupt. "I asked to be an apprentice," Hooper says. "I wanted to know every step of the process that's been perfected the Haupt way. I asked Kurt, how did you learn? He told me that one winter he needed gloves, and his father said, fine, I'm setting you up at this machine. Just get used to following the material. It takes a lot of time as you graduate to the next step." For 6 months, Haupt and his daughter, Heidi, taught Hooper the intricate steps to make the best work gloves in the world, and also why each step mattered, and Hooper kept graduating to the next one. He learned why the fibers in goatskin make it both simple and tough, how to look for the slightest imperfections in the leather, how to select and cut sections for thumbs, for fingers, for the back, why they sewed seams on the outside, so there would be more finger space inside, how to do the special double seams, and the tricky thumb attachments. He also learned that the incessant clatter of the company's sewing machines from the 1940s and 50s was the music of skilled sewers, some of whom had worked on the machines longer than he had been alive. By the end of his apprenticeship, Hooper could make a glove that would pass as a haupt. At night, he did market research, figuring out whether he could or should make the leap from student to owner. He decided yes, and in early 2018, Hooper became the first person outside the Haupt family to own the company. Heidi Haupt stayed on as operations manager and sewing supervisor, as well as keeper of institutional memory. Hooper knew the challenges. For one thing, the company's factory was showing its age. Driven by an environmental ethic, he converted the coal burner to wood pellets, retrofitted the building with its first layers of insulation, and added solar panels. Within 2 years, he had created a net zero user of power. He also needed to expand the customer base well beyond the time-honored utility worker. We can't lose sight that we make gloves for people where it's life and death that they are made right, he says. The fact that we make gloves for utility line workers gives us leverage. These gloves are made for people who trust their lives to them. Now they are for you. His most delicate decision was to rebrand the entire line. Green Mountain Glove Company became Vermont Glove. It was a bit scary, Hooper admits. They had a 100-year-old heritage. I did not want to offend the Haupt family. That name represented four generations of the best glove makers in the world. But I got their blessing. It was the right time if we were going to be widely known to consumers and not just utility workers. And when you ask people outside New England where the Green Mountains are, many don't know. But some traditions remain. For instance, many glove styles still bear names that read like codes, such as the most popular all-purpose glove, the AG47R0. I have no idea where that name comes from, Hooper says, but it doesn't matter. It's always been that name. It's kind of cool, really. And so, sometimes the young lead the way. The workforce has expanded, while the number of gloves that leave the factory each month is now more than 1,300 pairs. But we have to be careful we don't grow too fast, he says. Today, at age 30, Hooper works 80 to 90 hours a week. He lives in an old hunting camp on his family's 67-acre homestead. He still works outdoors as often as he can. Still works with a pair of gloves made just down the road, as comfortable and as strong as the first ones that made him go, wow. We think about who we are, our value system, Hooper says. It does matter. We are time-tested. We are still here. This is a testament. VermontGlove.com. The next article is by Joe Bills, entitled Grand Sam, the story behind Danbury, Connecticut's tall American hero. At an imposing 38 feet tall and 4,500 pounds, the fiberglass Uncle Sam statue that stands sentinel outside Connecticut's Danbury Railway Museum may be the world's largest, or maybe not. There's another one in the Midwest that's a tad taller, but only if the base is included in the calculations. Both statues are said to have been created in the 1960s as advertising icons for Uncle Sam's, a now-defunct, restaurant chain in Ohio. By 1971, one of the Sams had relocated to Connecticut for a new gig as a greeter at the Danbury Fair. After 10 years, it moved on, taking up residence at the Magic Forest theme park in Lake George, New York. When the park was sold in 2018, the statue next seemed destined for Troy, New York, where Massachusetts native Sam Wilson had operated a meatpacking business that supplied troops during the War of 1812. The term Uncle Sam is said to have derived from the U.S. stamp on Wilson's barrels, which marked them as government property, but also some fancy it as coming from Uncle Sam Wilson. Soon, Uncle Sam was being used as a stand-in for the government in political cartoons. in the 1870s, Harper's Weekly cartoonist Thomas Nast popularized what became Uncle Sam's signature look, thin, white-haired, goateed, and wearing a tall hat with striped pants, vest, and a swallow-tail coat. Then came James Montgomery Flagg's 1917 I Want You recruitment poster, which elevated Uncle Sam to pop culture celebrity and created perhaps America's first meme a century before anyone knew what that was. Patriotism sells, and in the years that followed, Uncle Sam's likeness promoted everything from apples to car insurance, and restaurants, of course. The Lake George statue never went to Troy, as Danbury swooped in as top bidder. In May 2019, after a few months of restoration, a rejuvenated Uncle Sam made his grand return to Connecticut as Danbury's biggest photo op. That's it for this installment of the Magazine Rack. I've been reading from the July-August issue of Yankee. I'm Ron Pariser. So long until next time.